Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall.
Fill the wall up with our English dead.
Yes. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We actually did it. First time.
We did it.
We said our names together. Now we can be done for the day and be happy.
I'm impressed, even with the digital lag.
Yeah, well, I'm just watching the non-digital video lag, and I'm able to watch your, it is digital video lag. I'm watching your lips move and just time it with your lag there, just so it'll still be hard to do if you're in Mars, but for across Salado, it's not a big deal. So we are broadcasting live from the studio in Temple and Salado virtually. So we're in Salado physically, virtually transmitting through the studio and Temple to the broadcast tower somewhere else.
Does that make us virtuous?
Virtuosos, maybe?
Well, you know, we're virtual. I mean, we're obviously virtuous or we couldn't be virtual.
As mom has said to me my whole life, be good or at least be good at it. So I think that describes too much in the world. This is The Personal Wealth Coach, and we have some disclosures to give before we start talking about the exciting, dreary science of economics. Very dismal. Exciting, dreary science. Yes?
Dismal.
Dismal.
Dismal science.
Dreary. Dismal.
Okay.
Rainy. Gray. Yes. But very exciting. For some of us. Anyway.
Yes.
For some of us. And I hopefully everybody listening finds it exciting the way we talk about it. It is certainly not exciting to most people when presented in a spreadsheet format. So that's our first disclosure, is that we will not be presenting any spreadsheets over the radio today. Next disclosure is that The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm that offers fiduciary investment advice. It's the same people on the program that are at that firm. So there's no coincidence here. There is a difference, though. At our firm, when we're talking one-on-one individually with people, we offer fiduciary investment advice. That means in the best interest of our clients. On the radio, we can't do that. We have to offer education because we don't know everybody we're talking to, and there's privacy restrictions. If we were giving you specific individual advice, well, then put in your social security number 003- you can see the point that we're trying to make here. So this program is based in education, and hopefully we'll give you some tools with which to make better decisions in your day-to-day life. At the very least, we can say a bunch of financial mumbo jumbo that you can drop in a conversation and allow people to think that you understand things, even though we don't even claim to understand it. Yes. That should be part of our disclosure. Please be advised that we neither claim to understand nor understand the majority of what we talk about. We just understand it better than other people sometimes.
There's some truth there.
Yeah. All right, you want to do the next disclosure?
We don't pay for the radio program.
That's right, we don't.
And we don't get paid to do the radio program, which is really goofy. We do advertise on KTEM, but Senator, there is no quid pro quo. KTEM advertises for the radio program, and so do we, because we like people to listen to the radio program, and we do have an ulterior motive here. In that we have a lot of clients that listen to the radio program, so we maintain good contact every week with our clients. And occasionally somebody who listens to the radio program comes to us for investment advice. But I don't think it's a very effective advertising mechanism.
I'm going to step into the disclosures just a moment. Can you tilt your microphone slightly away from your mouth? You sound like you are the pilot of the aircraft at the moment. There we go.
No. Please fasten your seat belts. We will encounter some bumpy words here in a few moments.
If everyone will please proceed to the left side of the aircraft. Whoa, no, get back, we're off center. Sorry.
No.
Yeah. Okay, so.
You want me to do another disclosure?
Yes, please. As long as it doesn't require us to move to the left side of the aircraft.
Okay. Information we present, we are providing information on this radio program, educational information, and the information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Or unsaid.
I don't know that that's actually a required disclosure, but it sure sounds cool.
We also make no guarantee of completeness for information left unsaid.
Mm.
In fact, we can guarantee that that information's incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, we did. We just made a guarantee.
Yes, we guaranteed that the information that we don't present is incomplete in its presented format.
Mm-hmm.
There are some guarantees we can give. Very few. Very few.
Seems like there's some other disclosures we need to give.
Let's see. You've got the advertisement, the not being paid. Fiduciary education. Let's see. Deemed reliable.
Oh.
Yeah. Huh? What is it?
You may join in the radio program.
That's not a disclosure.
It's sort of. It's February 12th. We're making this. This is a live program on February 12th, both over the internet and at KTEM. And if you would like to pose some questions to us or thoughts or comments or whatever, we are monitoring our email addresses, which are jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com. Or you can write Jake or jeff@thepersonalwealthcoach.com if you just like to type a lot.
Yeah, that's always available.
We will endeavor to answer your questions on the air. We already have two questions in from our favorite inquisitor, John, and we will be addressing those.
Yep.
Seems like there's something else we need to disclose, but I can't remember what.
Well, we got to talk about the market now.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. We have a stock market in the United States. It's traditionally called the biggest one historically is the New York Stock Exchange, which is located at 44 Wall Street. So when they say Wall Street is up or down, I've been to 44 Wall Street. I didn't observe it rising or falling, so I think that's false information.
They just need more fracking there. Then they'd have earthquakes, and you have a lot of volatility on Wall Street. That would be all it takes.
Yep. The S&P 500 is the index that we follow to mark the market, even though it's not necessarily an exact measure of what the whole stock market is doing. And it was having a great week this last week until Thursday. It looked like it was going to turn in a nice gain for the week. Everybody was really happy. And then two things happened. And we have been talking about in the newsletter for some time that there are three things on our radar that could really mess things up. One of them would be another variant of COVID comes sweeping through, like Omicron did. Another one was the Russians invading Ukraine. Well, actually, there's a double whammy to that one. It could be the Chinese invade Taiwan. Although that doesn't seem to be in the cards right now. And the third one was that the Federal Reserve suddenly have a fit and raise interest rates to a ridiculous level. Well, on Thursday, James Bullard, the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank president, who is a member of the Federal Reserve Board and a voting member, said he had become very hawkish and he wanted to see interest rates, which are effectively at zero, short-term interest rates, which are effectively at zero right now, up to 1% by July, which means that they will need to raise them relatively quickly. He also said he would support a raise in interest rates other than at a meeting. In other words, in between their monthly meetings, he would support raising interest rates, which kind of scared folks. Why does that scare folks? Well, really no really good reason for it, but there's actually a formula that you can use. It's called present value, and the higher the interest rates, the lower the present value, and we can go into that in lots of detail and put you to sleep if you'd like. But bottom line to it is, when you look at the proposed, which you looked at the forecast future earnings, I like that, of large capitalization growth companies on the stock market, which through the pandemic have been leading the stock market upward. you can figure the present value of the company ought to be this. And if it's below that, people have been buying. And if it gets above it, they start to sell. And since interest rates went up, the present value of that company, by that calculation, goes down a little bit, which means that there were probably some selling went on. And then that caused everybody who didn't have a lot of experience to get scared because, oh, the market's going down, so we should sell. That's, by the way, an interesting philosophy that doesn't work too well. But that happened. And then there's the other thing that happened, which is, I think, in some ways bigger and in some ways smaller. We can talk about interest rates and Bullard and where the interest rates are likely to go and how dangerous it really is, which isn't. But something that's really scary is going on, and it was announced, more of it was announced today, of course, and that is that Russia appears to be gearing up to invade Ukraine. And this would be the biggest military actual war in Europe since World War II. Even if it's a limited invasion, it's going to be big. It is so reminiscent of the beginning of World War II when Germany was saying, there are German-speaking people out there who are not in Germany, and we think they're being discriminated against, and we think that they're in danger, so we're going to invade the countries where people speak German and take them back into Germany. And Russia, Putin is saying the same thing. The embassy, the Russian embassy, is being evacuated. Now, the U.S. embassy backing out of there, okay, that's a precaution.
That is happening, and it's a precaution. But the Russians leaving...
The Russians leaving is pretty significant because there's no evidence that the United States is going to invade Ukraine. We don't have the capability of invading Ukraine at this point.
If you point at the fact that, very, very simply, the Americans are leaving and their espoused reason for leaving is, hey, it looks like the Russians are about to invade. And the Russians are leaving their diplomatic posts and their espoused reason is, hey, it looks like the Russians are getting ready to invade. Only it's not really. They're just like, oh, nothing. We're just leaving for a little while. Everything is good. It's fine.
And on Thursday and Friday, that was the news. And as a result, the market turned down. But it didn't turn down a lot. The S&P 500 was down 1.82% for the week. It closed at 4418.64. It's up 12.3% from this time last year, which is quite good. The analysts who are out there were two sets of analysts, two voices speaking. The perennial, what I call perennial doomsayers, and there are certain people, Jeremy Grantham, among others, who are always calling for a bear market, literally always calling for a bear market. Even when we have a bear market and we hit bottom, they call for more bear market. And they're saying major bear market is coming, but that's nothing new because they always say a major bear market is coming. Then you have analysts who are looking at those famous formulas that I just told you about, and they say this is the cheapest the market has been in 2 years. Now, what does that mean? That means that even though the market is up 12% in the last year and up a lot in the last 2 years, earnings have risen faster than that. We're getting some really good earnings reports in this year so far based on fourth quarter of last year.
Now, just throwing this in, that doesn't mean that there aren't pieces of the market that are way too expensive, but sure, the overall market's what we're talking about here.
Right. And the people who actually do the number crunching and have professionals, they've looked out there and said, this market is relatively inexpensive. And in fact, they've used the term cheap. It's a bargain. And you can listen to one or you can listen to the other. We don't really have an opinion on that subject right now. We don't think the market is overpriced or underpriced because the market is priced at whatever the market is priced. We don't see things being crazy. The other index that we follow, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. Now, why do we follow another index? The S&P 500 index is the largest 500 companies by market capitalization. In other words, the total value of all their stock traded in the United States. The mid-cap value is obviously much smaller because it's not large cap value. And mid-cap value means it's not based on, what do you want me to do?
move your mic just a little bit. We're getting a lot of S's and T's. You really sound like an airline captain again. That's better.
Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. The mid-cap value means it's smaller companies. It's not small companies because the small companies aren't in the S&P 500. It's mid-sized companies. And they're selected because this particular set of companies is selected because they tend to trade based on the underlying value of the assets of the company, of the company's operations and assets. They tend to not be priced based on what is hoped to be their earnings in the future. So that's kind of two different ways of looking at the market. One is large, the other one is somewhat smaller. One is based on potential future growth, the other one is based on what is it worth today.
Right.
So they kind of at the opposite ends of the spectrum. Now that was interesting because the mid-cap value index, the CRSP mid-cap value index, rose 0.44% for the week.
At the same time that the S&P 500 was down for the week.
Yeah. And the S&P 500 was down a lot more than it was down 1.82%. The CRSP mid-cap value index was up 0.44%. By the way, this is a classic, what we call rotation in the market, which tends to be quite healthy. It closed at 2540.09 for those who follow such things, which suggests that there is a rotation going on from high growth, potential high growth stocks, which tend to be risky, to value stocks and from large to small. It's no guarantee, but the CRSP index is only down 2.2% this year, whereas the S&P 500 is down 7 point something, basically in the upper sevens. The other side of the market that we look at, the U.S. Treasury note was kind of exciting if you're a market geek like we are.
This is the 10-year note.
The 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which, by the way, is the benchmark for all bond trades in the United States, all bond pricing. On all this stuff started going on, the yield on the U.S. Treasury note jumped above 2%. It was on Thursday. It spiked again Friday morning, and then it slipped back down again to 1.915, which is pretty much where it was last week. And basically, that was generated by another piece of news that popped out on the market this week. And that was that, we'll talk about that too, that inflation year over year was 1.7%, 1.75%, I think it was. Anyway, it was up a bunch.
Yeah.
But
year over year, it was not 1.7%.
Oh, it was 7%.
Yes, not 1%. Yeah. There's a big, big, big difference between the two.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And that's important. In essence, the bond
7.5%,
market, which is
7.5%. That's
the 7.5%. The bond market, in essence, is saying, and the bond market doesn't actually speak. It's the collective wisdom of all those what we call mavens. And at least the Wall Street Journal refers to them as mavens, the bond traders. They're saying that over the next 10 years, they basically expect inflation, and there's a esoteric way of looking at this. You look at the inflation-adjusted bond, what they're trading at versus the regular 10-year bond, what that's trading at, it's Treasury. And you see that basically the collective wisdom of the bond market is that interest rates for the 10-year, inflation rather, over the next 10 years is likely to be about 2.5% in their collective wisdom. So that's cool. Not 7% or whatever we're seeing right now. So the other one that's out there, West Texas Intermediate crude oil, that's another economic indicator that tends to lead the economy. They slid downward all week until Friday when they jumped back up to 93.87. That put them up 2.1% for the week. Why do they rise on Friday? Well, the word on the street, at least according to the Wall Street Journal and other folks, was that if and I'm almost ready to say when Russia invades Ukraine, Russia's contribution to the world oil supply is likely to be embargoed. And that would reduce the world oil supply, which would cause the price of oil to go up. And I think that's a very reasonable thought process, by the way. We've talked for some time now that we expect to see $100 per barrel oil going into the summer. And I think that's a real probability at this point. It's not that far. It's only $6.13 away from that right now. So I think we could very easily see $100. And that means get used to the fact that you're going to be paying more for gasoline.
Yeah, I was filled up yesterday and it was nearly $4 a gallon. I felt like it was 10 years ago. Oh, yeah, I've had this before, haven't we? 10 yep. years ago was when the fracking boom really took off because the prices got so high. So we've got some benefits that can offset the detriments in that we're likely to ramp up our production during this time period. And probably folks in Texas are going to make a lot of money, probably in North Dakota as well. So there's good to the bad and bad to the good. It just depends on which side of the trade you're on. Just keep that in mind. Yes.
If you're using gasoline, that means that you're going to be paying more. And if you're owning oil fields and have oil wells on your property, you're going to be
right.
making more.
Just use the extra dividends from your Exxon to pay for your pump gas. Right. So that's
we can talk about that a little bit. We can talk about that a little bit at some point, too, how energy stocks have done over the last decade. I was looking at it this week, even with their big run-up in the last year.
Right.
They basically have done, they haven't quite kept up with inflation over the last 10 years.
But we have a couple of questions from John, our great questioner, Inquisitor John. Thank you very much for your loyal support here. This is, or maybe loyal curiosity. We've talked about I-bonds before on the program, and his first question is about I-bonds.
U-bonds?
I-bonds.
Ah.
U-bond? I-bond.
Mm-hmm. I-bond.
I-bond is a direct from the United States Treasury savings bond.
Yeah, savings bond. That's an important thing to say. They're not publicly traded bonds. They don't go up and down with the market. They are U.S. savings bonds that can only be sold back to the government.
For those of you who have no clear memory of this, just think back to your childhood when grandma would give you savings bonds and you would say, "What is? Can I use this to buy candy?" And your parents would say, "No, we're going to put them in a closet and we'll figure out what to do with them at some point in the next 8 decades. We don't know how to use them." Saving bonds have, I mean, it's something that they do in Japan with a lot of their money. Savings bonds were issued to help pay for short-term, long-term things at the governmental level. It's an IOU. It's a, hey, we'll give you an interest rate on this. And an I-bond is not that different from other saving bonds. You have to get it directly from the government. treasurydirect.gov. You can't go to a brokerage firm and get these things. It's not available.
Or a bank.
Or a bank.
Banks used to sell them and they don't anymore.
Right. So we talked about this several months ago, back in November and December, about them paying a huge amount of interest, 7%+ interest rates, which people were like, why is that going on? Well, what did we just say inflation was? Is it 7.5%? And the interest rate that was being offered at that point is a calculation that's supposed to keep up with inflation. So we said, hey, there's some, number one, there's some real restrictions on how you get these things. They have to be purchased in $10,000 increments. You can't get $1,000 worth.
Yeah, you can get less. The maximum is $10,000.
I was pretty sure that you could get them. I-bond is only available in $10,000 increments. You can look that up while I continue to talk about the other restrictions. You have to hold them for a year if you want to get, basically, if you buy it, you can't sell it back to the government for a year. There's no place you can sell it for a year. You could probably sell it to your mom or your uncle or your brother, but even that, you have to prove to the Treasury Department that it was you that bought it. So keep that in mind.
$50 is a small
$50. Spot. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it comes in little increments.
I'm sorry. My mistake. $25 is the smallest.
Okay.
Spot. You can buy them anywhere from $25 to $10,000.
Okay. So when you step into these, the interest rate is there, but you've got to hold them for a year before they have any value to you. So if this is money that you're going to need this year, this is a bad place to put it. It's got a great interest rate right now, but you got to follow these restrictions. Even after a year, when you liquidate, you'll lose 3 months of the interest payment. You have to hold it for 5 years before you can take the whole amount. You have something
to
say?
It's a lot like going to the bank and getting a certificate of deposit. Most banks, most of the time, if you liquidate a certificate deposit before its maturity date, you'll lose 90 days interest.
Yeah, but there aren't that many CDs that won't let you liquidate at all in the first year. So that's
a
major difference.
And therein is the difference. And the 10,000 max per person is the difference too.
Right. So that all being said, the question from John is, not sure if this is a question for the show. We're going to use it anyway. Depending on who you believe, the Fed is going to raise rates multiple times this year, either 3 or 7 times, ? And we'll talk about that in just a minute too. Would you recommend laddering these bonds since the interest rate changes? Maybe do bond purchases monthly or quarterly till you meet the maximum allowed.
No,
because in a rising interest rate environment, laddering isn't the greatest approach.
It's important, John, that you note that you said bonds. We say savings bonds, and there's a world difference between buying a bond, a treasury bond, and buying a savings bond. Treasury bonds fluctuate with market value. If interest rates go up, the treasury bond that you hold, the value on the market will go down. The I-bonds are, at this point, going to be fundamentally unaffected by changes in interest rates. If you buy an I-bond right now from the Treasury Direct, you are getting zero interest rates, but an annualized rate of 7% inflation adjustment. Because literally, the I-bonds that you buy from the Treasury right now have an underlying interest rate of zero. They just have a 7% inflation adjustment, so they pay on an annualized basis 7%. And they will adjust that again based on the inflation rate reported. I think it's in March. The next adjustment is in May. It's either March or April's looking back consumer price index. I think it's March they use. It's what they adjust them to.
Okay. I have one thing to add to something that you said. That you said that they could get down to $25.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you are absolutely correct. But they have two minimums. One is for electronic and one is for paper purchases. And they give you both of those numbers, $25 for electronic. That's the minimum purchase. Or $50 if you're buying it in paper. However, at the top of the screen on the Treasury Direct, it says, as of January 1st of 2012, 10 years ago, paper savings bonds are no longer sold. So that just keeps in mind, $25 is the minimum, and you would actually have to go literally to a Treasury location to buy the paper version of the bond, because they're not sold through financial institutions.
And I don't think they actually sell them there anymore. But
right. You have to go to Treasury Direct, but they still give you a minimum purchase amount required is $50 for paper, but they don't give you paper anymore. So this is just government bureaucracy in a normal setting. Just, yes, minimum is 50, except that you can't get it that way. So our actual minimum is 25. Well, why didn't you just say that? Oh, well, we should have, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
There we go.
Well, and the same is true of regular savings bonds, except regular savings bonds, that's double E savings bonds, are paying a whopping 0% right now, I think.
Right. And this up till April, we'll be paying 7.12%. It's likely that if we're experiencing high inflation at that point, the inflation adjustment will likely be high then too.
I stand corrected. Treasury Direct is paying 0.10% for double E savings bonds.
Okay.
If you want to buy
them right now. So that is a 0.1%. You said zero. You were so off on this. Oh my goodness.
I'm completely wrong.
You totally missed 0.1%.
Yes. And
shameful.
But the The ones we're talking about are Series I savings bonds.
Yes.
There's no need to ladder them because you ladder bonds because interest rates change.
These change in the system. That bond, the same issue that you have, will continue. It won't be locked at this rate for 5 years. It changes every 6 months or so, 5.5 months. It's got a weird schedule. Mm.
So it's a good place if you are willing to lock them. I mean, when I say lock the money up, you cannot liquidate them for 1 year. So that's locked up. If you're willing to lock up $10,000 and it's significant to you per person. So if you have a husband or wife, for example, you can buy $20,000 worth and you're willing to lock it up for that period of time and you want to get a really good interest rate on your $20,000, that's a good place to do it. And there is zero risk.
The only risk is that if you need it in the first year.
Yeah.
So the government's going to pay you back. And that is considered universally, the United States government right now is universally considered zero risk. Whether or not that's true, obliged by Constitution to pay the debts.
Well, I think it's zero risk too, because it's basically, it's as valuable as the dollar that you're going to get out of it. So the only thing that could cause it to do something bad would be the dollar to collapse, which incidentally, if the dollar collapsed because of high inflation, let's say inflation went to 30%. Well, guess what? Your Series I savings bond interest rate would go to 30%. So that's another good reason to buy them. That's why they don't issue a lot of those, because paying out 7% interest to the public, 7-point-something% interest on a lot of money would probably make the people in the Treasury and the Congress be very unhappy.
Why are we doing that? Well, because it's fair. Oh, stop it immediately! All right, so we have another question, and it's interest rate related. And I kind of hit a bunch of this, so you want to start this one? So I hit the last one.
John had a very good question. He pulled it out of the Wall Street Journal. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about this, and that is that there's little question at this point that the Fed is about to raise short-term interest rates. And there's the part of the Wall Street Journal he has circled, and when he sent us the picture, a guy named Jim Caron, the senior portfolio manager and chief strategist of global fixed income at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. And that is a big title. Somebody says, what do you do? And he says, I'm the senior portfolio manager and chief strategist of global fixed income at Morgan Stanley Investment Management.
When you ask somebody what you do and they give you a business card that has 5 pages, this is it.
Yeah. He's estimating that the Fed will raise short-term rates eventually to around 2%. And that's not at all unreasonable. Yeah,
that's a pretty run-of-the-mill estimate for most people.
And it's pretty close to what we had the Fed short-term rates at before the pandemic. But he said the fact that they're reducing their bond holdings this year could add the equivalent of an additional 0.25% point increase. What happens is raising interest rates by the Fed causes loans to be more expensive at the bank in other places. Yeah. Interest rates go up, mortgage rates go up, everything goes up because banks borrow money from the Fed routinely. And if they're borrowing at 0%, they can afford to charge you very, very low interest rates and still make a profit. So if interest rates go up, the banks are going to raise what they're charging people to borrow money. And bond rates are going to tend to go up during that period, which means corporations are going to find it more expensive to borrow money, which is one of the reasons that people are a little nervous about high growth stocks that have never made a profit because they're functioning on borrowed money. And if the interest rates go up, it'll be more expensive for them. What's the extra 0.25% increase that's mentioned in here? The Fed is also said very clearly, and they made this very abundantly clear, they're going to be shrinking the balance sheet, which is pretty esoteric sounding. That means they leave it out in the rain, and because of the water that gets on it, it tends to shrink. No. There's two ways the Fed can shrink their balance sheet. One, they've been buying bonds on the open market. Now, as they buy bonds on the open market, they're taking bonds from people in corporations and banks, and exchanging and giving them cash. Now, people then have more cash to spend, which means there's more money in circulation, which increases liquidity and causes interest rates to go down and people to spend more money.
Let me throw in a real quick thing. Why would more money in the economy cause interest rates to go down? Because when there's more money out there, there's more people willing to lend it to people. And if you have five people trying to lend you money, it's easier to negotiate than if there's only one place you can go to get a loan. So the more money out there, the lower interest rates kind of reasonably go. Where if you stop pumping more money in there, it doesn't make less money by itself, but people are spending money. So it does kind of get frictioned away. It goes into bank accounts. It goes into purchases of assets, into the stock market, things like that. So there's less money available to give loans.
Right. What in the shrinking of the balance sheet, and this is what some investors and strategists are afraid of, the Fed could actually go into the open market and start selling bonds. If they do that, it will cause interest rates to go up in the long end of the curve, and it will make mortgages more expensive. It will make borrowing money by corporations a lot more expensive, and it's a pretty radical thing to do. They've done it in the past, and that they have, by the way, the Fed, by doing that aggressively in the past, has actually generated recessions. On the other hand, they could do what a lot of Fed observers, and I personally think they're likely to do, which is not sell the bonds into the open market, which tends to sop up money and lower the money supply and cause the economy to slow down and do lots of things. Simply stop buying. And when they stop buying, then as the bonds they own mature, so let's just say they had a mortgage bond and it matures in 2023 and they've got $100,000 of an issue, and we'll keep the number small, or a million or whatever. They simply don't buy another bond. And when that bond matures, whoever had borrowed the money returns the money to the Fed. So when a bond matures, let's say you have a $1,000 bond from the Treasury or from anywhere, from a Treasury bond, when it matures, you get $1,000 back.
That's the maturity.
You've been getting the interest. You've been getting the interest all along, but you get $1,000 back. So if that $1,000 then was converted, it was interestingly enough, at the other end, it basically sucks $1,000 out of the economy. And if the Fed simply stops buying bonds, it will, as they mature, stop renewing them.
When the Fed owns a bond, the United States government is getting a loan from the Fed. That's what's happening. Mm-hmm. The Fed says, here's a loan. We're just calling it a bond here. We're going to give you a loan, government. When that matures, the government says to the Fed, here's your money for the purchase. Here's the total amount. Then the Fed has money in its pocket instead of a bond in its pocket. But it's not in circulation. It's not out there where everybody's spending it. The Fed's holding it, and it's on its books.
Except, particularly for Treasury bonds, they simply give the money back to the government.
The interest. They give the interest back to the government. They don't give the maturity back. The maturity is based on what they hold in their balance sheets.
Sure.
So.
So basically, they will be sucking every time a bond, with quotations around it, is $1,000.
Right.
So with each bond that matures, they will effectively, by not buying another bond to replace it, they will effectively take $1,000 out of circulation. And all they have to do is not buy anymore and just sit there passively. And the estimate in this article of it being the equivalent of a 0.25% rate increase at the short term, it's just the economic impact of the Fed stopping buying new bonds.
Right.
And that's the highest probability, in my opinion, that they're going to do. Now, if they were to go out there and start selling bonds into the open market, that would be, frankly, a little scary.
Yeah. That would actually be pulling money out of a situation. That's not something that anything in the Fed minutes has suggested for the past, since the pandemic started. They're talking about tapering. They're still not even talking about the full stopping of purchases on the market. That's still happening. We're talking about tapering right now. So the article in question here is there's some time periods that are mildly missing. Back in December, the Federal Reserve minutes were saying probably 3 rate increases in 2022. The kind of consensus is that by the end of 2023, it'll be like at 1.6%, and 2024, probably 2.2. So several years out, this article says, well, what if it happens in 2023 that we get up to 2%? Well, that would be the equivalent of an extra, just about one extra rate increase. Is that possible? Yeah. If we still see large inflation after the Fed's action, which you said there's little question that they will be raising rates in March, they have basically promised repeatedly since December that they will be raising rates in March. It would be a massive slap in the face to everyone if they did not. So we're just going to say they're planning on raising rates in March. Once they do that, we're going to see some other shifts in the market. You're probably going to see a lot of panics. They're raising rates! You're going to see the market react to that. How do we know that in advance? Because it generally does. Even though they have repeatedly promised to do this, there are some people out there that still say, nah, well, for whatever reason. And then when they hear the headline, it scares them. So just be aware that that's likely to happen. It may be that we'll see the market act all kinds of goofy, up and down, crazy before the announcement and then stabilize after the announcement. But usually we have volatility for the week surrounding it. Just expect bumpiness, even though we have a pretty good idea what they're going to do.
The article that John sent, which has an interesting title to it that I think is very important, said elevated bond yields approach key milestone. That was 2%. And indeed, back when this article was published, they were cranking up towards 2%. But it was published on the 7th, which is now ancient history.
Yes.
It was days ago. Cuneiform on stones or something like that. The interest rates were churning upward and had crossed the 2% rate, as we mentioned earlier. And they turned around and came back the other way. And they came back the other way because, let me tell you, if Russia invades Ukraine, interest rates will probably drop. So will the stock market. And we'll talk about that some more after we do commercials.
Yeah, we have avoided commercials. We've got a stand-in producer who is an outstanding stand-in producer in the studio right now. And Aaron, thank you very much for being the pinch hitter here, even though you've got the high batting average across, you're much appreciated across the board here. Get it across the board. I made it.
He's outstanding in his field.
Yes. No, that's a farmer.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes. So if you'd like to join the conversation, we have email addresses waiting diligently without sleep for your email to approach. It is either Jeff at tpwc.com, as in Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the personal wealth coach, or Jake, if I can say my own name, at tpwc.com, Jake at tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements with more of the personal wealth coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We did it twice. I don't know. That's scary. We push our luck anymore? We can say
this
our name.
Really scary. Three in a row, I think, would be a record since we've gone digital.
Right. Well, we've got a little under 8 minutes left this hour. We've got another hour coming up afterwards, but we have a lot of big headlines that we basically not said anything about. Number one, U.S. trade deficit hit record in 2021 as Americans spent on computers and games. This is a headline from the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. trade deficit increased 27% last year to an all-time high of $859 billion. What is that? It says, underscoring the strength of the nation's economy and its continued hefty dependence on imports from China and other countries. That's absolutely correct. Even though things are more expensive, they're less more expensive from China than they are from other parts of the world. How can you say less more expensive? Well, they didn't go up as fast as other parts of the world. Now, that may not continue because contracts have a date at which they end, usually. And purchasing from China, they're having some inflation happening as well. Quite strong inflation, same as we are. So keeping that in mind, what happened here? Well, we had deficits going up during the trade war. This is very normal during trade wars. It's extremely normal in the United States for prices to be up, and that caused it to look like we're importing more stuff. Because if you imported $100 billion 1 year and you imported $125 billion the next year, it looks like you imported more stuff. When the reality is you may have imported the same amount of stuff with a 25% tariff. Make sense so far? What we saw last year had little to do with the trade war, although that still exists. We still have tariffs on washing machines and refrigerators and solar panels and aluminum and steel and all kinds of things that were not there before the trade war started. Where the trade war hasn't ended. It's just been sort of forgotten. It made big headlines while it was coming out, and now there are bigger headlines that have completely washed it out. The trade war is ongoing, and that is part of the deficit that we're seeing in trade. That's one part of it. Another part of it is that we are actually buying more things. And the things that we are buying are more expensive. We have more money in our pockets than we did before the pandemic started. And that's pretty important to understand. When the Federal Reserve makes money, it's because either money has been destroyed from bad loans, or they issue it in loans. When we talk about interest rates changing at the Federal Reserve, it's because they're making loans to banks. Banks have an obligation, and that obligation is to maintain a certain amount of reserve on hand so that when you show up and say, hey, I would actually like to buy the TV I want to buy with the money in my bank account, it's actually there for you to use. So when interest rates raise, it's because and it costs these banks money. If they've loaned out more money than they should have, they've got to go to the Federal Reserve and get a loan. That's what changes here. The Federal Reserve can manufacture money to do that with. They have to do it carefully, and they don't want to make it too cheap or we get inflation. They don't want to make it too expensive or we get deflation. But we manufacture the dollars. We haven't really finished up on trade deficit, and that's a big headline, a record there. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we do that too. And you can reach a voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week if you call locally.
947-1111. That's area code 254-947-1111.
Or toll free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, read our newsletter, listen to the radio program going back lots of years. You can go anywhere to find the podcast that you would normally find podcasts. You can also use the contact form on the webpage to talk to us or email us directly at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next hour, we really appreciate you listening. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach, and we got lots more good stuff to talk about.